eyes of the world, the eyes of the populations of the world are on you, and we have your numbers.
That lingering sense of fleas remains, and we'll see what comes next.
We need to make sure that what sits there on a piece of paper is actually going to turn into tangible, actionable projects on the ground that are going to make a difference to people's lives.
You're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Ewan Potts. So, an apology from Boris Johnson. The Prime Minister told an angry House of Commons he had attended a Downing Street garden party during a lockdown in 2020. He may have brought himself a bit of breathing space, but simmering disquiet within the Conservative Party means his grip on power is weaker now than it was just a few days ago.
Mr. Speaker, I want to apologise. I know that millions of people across this country have made extraordinary sacrifices over the last 18 months. I know the anguish that they have been through.
Well, following his mea culpa moment, most Tory MPs interviewed by Bloomberg said they would wait for the findings of a probe by civil servant Sue Gray before deciding on any next steps. It would take 54 MPs writing to the 1922 committee to trigger a vote on the Prime Minister's future. But the list of possible signees is starting to stack up. Among the Tories publicly calling for his resignation, a Scottish leader, Douglas Ross, along with MPs Roger Gale, Will Ragg and Caroline Noakes. With the Prime Minister's position remaining precarious, one of his Cabinet colleagues faces a difficult choice in resetting the post-Brexit talks over Northern Ireland. Meanwhile, here's Bloomberg's Hannah George.
Do you pick a fight with the European Union to please the Conservative Party faithful or cut a deal to avert a trade war? That's the dilemma facing the Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, who meets with her European counterpart Maros Sefcovic today. The UK wants fundamental changes to the Northern Ireland Protocol and how it is overseen, while the EU has offered limited concessions around the customs burden facing traders moving goods across the Irish Sea. While Truss's first talk since taking on the mantle of lead Brexit negotiator had been billed as a reset, following a tougher line against the EU would strengthen her position should she throw her hat in the ring for a leadership challenge against Boris Johnson.
Well, let's bring in our first guest for the day, Graham Stringer, Labour MP for Blakely and Broughton in Greater Manchester. Graham, thanks so much for joining us on the programme today. Now, Keir Starmer and other opposition politicians say that Boris Johnson should resign. Do you think he actually will?
I don't think he will last very long, is my answer to that. I don't think he will resign immediately. Boris Johnson is Prime Minister because he can persuade people to vote Conservative that no other Conservative leader has managed to do in recent times. So he's won seats that have been Labour for generations. It looks to me as though he's lost that ability to get support from previous Labour voters. I think the test for him will come. There are local elections on the first Thursday in May. If Conservative candidates do badly in that, then I think there will be sufficient Conservatives who say, you've got to go, and there will be a vote of confidence, which he will lose.
So you think May will be the real crunch point for the Prime Minister?
That will be the test. The electorate is real test.
The people of Salford don't much like the Tories anyway, I think it's probably fair to say. What do you think the feeling is amongst your constituents? Do you think they're not really surprised at these allegations, or are they genuinely shocked?
They're not surprised that the Prime Minister of our country is a hypocrite and a liar. Very sadly, that position has been established some time ago. He has survived in the way that naughty children survive at the back of a classroom by a certain amount of charm and being able to achieve things that his predecessors had failed to do, like getting out of the European Union, winning elections. I think the people I talk to in Manchester and Salford are horrified that when they couldn't visit relatives in care homes, when some of them couldn't visit dying relatives in order to say goodbye, Boris Johnson was partying with friends and colleagues in number 10 Downing Street. I think they're genuinely angry and shocked at that level of hypocrisy, telling people to do one thing with criminal consequences. I mean, this wasn't just telling people, there was the law. Telling people to do one thing with criminal consequences, and he was doing exactly the opposite. He was having a good time at a drinks party in the garden in Downing Street.
And yet, despite that, a YouGov poll taken after the revelations but before the apology, which found that 6 in 10 people want Johnson to go. Looking at the voting intention numbers, Labour's on just 38%, barely moved since the last poll. It still feels like we're a long way from the days of Tony Blair as opposition leader when Labour was polling 45 or 50%, doesn't it?
The last opinion poll that I know has been taken showed Labour 10 points ahead, which is about where you would expect an opposition party to be in mid-term. It's not as good as it should be in some ways, given what has happened. I accept that. And I think Keir Starmer, Labour's leader, has created the necessary conditions in order that Labour may win the next general election, but he's not yet done sufficient to ensure that that outcome is likely. I think he has to talk to a number of issues that so far he's not addressed in the kind of detail and effectiveness that will shore up that opinion poll lead. That includes immigration, it includes the future of taxation and the huge taxation burden is going to be if we carry on heading to net zero, and less substantially, but just as importantly, some of the language around the woke issues that traditional Labour voters tend not to like.
So you say Labour's position is not as good as it should be. Do you think that Keir Starmer is too much of a metropolitan liberal, to use a phrase?
I wouldn't put it in those terms. And he was extraordinarily good in the House of Commons chamber in this. He got both the mood right as well as a forensic analysis of what Johnson was saying and what he was doing. So he was very good yesterday, and he has improved within the Commons chamber since he's been leader. He's not really come over to people who don't think about politics every day. He's not had the moment where they say, yeah, he's our guy, we want him to be the next Prime Minister. People are giving him the benefit of the doubt. They think he's a decent guy, but he's not broken through yet, and he's got to do that.
And do you think that's particularly a problem in those red wall seats surrounding Greater Manchester, where Labour did so badly last time?
It is a problem if you look at the results last time. If we're talking about opinion polls, the last opinion poll in those ex-Labour seats in areas that used to have a strong industrial base and no longer do have. The last poll done in those seats showed Labour 16 percentage points ahead. And I suppose the way I would put that is people are fed up with the Conservatives, and so that, you know, there were still narrow wins for the Conservatives in those seats, so they've stopped supporting them. What we've not completely done is persuade them to vote enthusiastically for Labour. So when you get to less marginal seats, but the seats we need to win, we need to do better there. That's where we need to communicate.
On the subject of energy bills, we've got a big, big rise in bills coming down the line in just a few months' time. Labour have said they'd like to cut 5% VAT. Is that going to be enough for the people of Salford?
It's a start. No, it isn't. Labour said two things. One is a cut in VAT, and the second is a windfall tax on the energy companies, because the energy companies have made money by doing nothing, just because the price of fossil fuels have gone up. So I think both those things are a start. But at the moment, on domestic fuel bills, there is about 25% that's not to pay for the fuel, but is to pay green levies to move to other forms of energy supply away from fossil fuels. And I think that is not a sustainable position. And that is very difficult for the Labour Party to change. But I think we have to change and say people want a cleaner, better environment. Everybody wants that. But the actual cash charge for this at the moment is too high.
On the issue of the Plan B restrictions, you're one of a small number of Labour MPs voting against vaccine passports. Why did you take that position?
I'm against a two-class society. It would exclude some people without the vaccine passports from certain areas of activity. I think that's wrong. I think if people... I'm triply vaccinated. I think people should get vaccinated. It's a defence against severe disease. It reduces transmission or doesn't stop it. So I think those two reasons. But there is a third significant reason. If, like I do, you believe that more people should be vaccinated and it's good for them and good for society generally, then forcing people to do it is not necessarily the best way to do it. Persuasion, explaining the benefits to them and other people of doing it.
Well, let's get more on what's making news in the world of politics. Of that, I'm joined by Bloomberg's James Walcock, who has his ear, of course, to the ground in all things Westminster. Now, James, the FT's Sebastian Payne tweeted that Sue Gray won't finish an investigation into the Downing Street parties until next week at the earliest. Now, talk us through what's next for Johnson.
So, I mean, this investigation, to sort of draw it back a bit, the reason why it matters so much is, to begin with, Sue Gray is the sort of mythical figure that Tory MPs have been tweeting about, this idea that this independent-minded civil servant will somehow put the issue to rest and put sort of Johnson's career back in sort of good condition if after all these queries about it. So, in many ways, this investigation will settle the issue for Johnson one way or the other. If the Met sort of take it on and take it further, it would be, like a lot of Tory MPs have said, that's game over. And the other side of this is that if you look at sort of the Chancellor's tweets last night, it was quite clear that his support of the Prime Minister is conditional until this inquiry comes out. So officials have been steering us away from any expectation for this week. Like you just said, the FT said next week at the earliest. So in some ways, this is the next sort of ticking clock for how long Johnson may have left.
That tweet from Sunak was pretty brutal, wasn't it, really? I mean, I'm sure his trip to Devon was long planned ahead, but it took him a long time to send it, didn't it?
It did. It took 8 hours. There's some brilliant timelines you can find, and he was one of the last cabinet ministers to express his support of Johnson. Following him an hour later was Liz Truss, another big frontrunner for the leadership. So I think it weirdly reminds me of back in sort of Theresa May's sort of dog days. You started to see the cabinet ministers who were thinking about their own careers and thinking about potential succession plans starting to differentiate themselves and pull back their support. And that is another thing to sort of keep your eye out on over the next sort of few weeks.
Just a quick one, a big name from the pandemic playing field. Jonathan Van Tam is leaving the match.
Leaving the match, final whistle. I wouldn't say red card, but well, University of Nottingham maybe have given him a red card because he left the Monster Common back in 2017. And now 5 years later, after having an extension, he's been drawn away. So it's not sort of a political move or anything. It's simply the case that after a very, very long pandemic, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer has returned to sort of academia. And I'm sure everyone wishes him all well.
James, thanks so much. James Walcott there with a little bit of a background on the day's event. Now let's get more analysis with a friend of the programme, Bloomberg opinion columnist Therese Raphael. Therese, thanks so much for joining us today. I read in your latest piece, you've written about the succession battle perhaps kicking off. It was pretty painful, wasn't it, yesterday? A really, as you put it, uncharacteristic apology. He was not enjoying himself yesterday, was he?
No, he was had a very sort of sober, sobering tone. His body language, the body language of, you know, his own cabinet members and parties, by the way, was, you know, not terribly supportive either. I mean, they were all masked, so you couldn't really, you know, see what the facial expressions were. But, you know, normally you expect when the prime minister is standing at the dispatch box and defending himself that he gets a lot of support from the back benches and certainly from his own cabinet. And there was just a sort of stony silence. And, you know, as James said, the the tweets of support from key cabinet members who are often mooted as potential replacements came very late in the day, looked quite conditional. So, you know, we keep saying he bought himself a bit of time, but I think the question is to what end?
So far, the actual list of people sticking their head above the parapet is still quite a short list, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's, some of the usual suspects, like Roger Gales, who's, been a big critic of Johnson for some time, who said he's put in a letter, I think Caroline Noakes and William Ragg. So, I mean, there are some, I think there are more voices now saying that his position is either untenable or that pending this review, it might be. And that will give him pause. You know, that said, getting to 54 letters to the 1922 committee at this point, that just still seems like a big stretch for those who want to see him go. And the fact that you have the Liberal Democrats and the Labour and, Labour Party now actively calling for his resignation, obviously the SNP, that may just encourage Tories to rally behind their leader and at least see if he can pull one out of the hat yet again, as James says, by the next, by the midterm elections. And I think part of this play for time is about seeing whether, the furore over this just dies down in the next week or so. I very much doubt it will, but one can never count out this prime minister. He has an uncanny way of kind of resurrecting himself when you sort of think the situation is completely lost.
Yeah, pretty Teflon. How important is the Sue Gray investigation and what are the possible outcomes and what could they mean for Johnson?
Well, I think a lot depends on how much she goes into sort of defining things like what is a party? Was it a party? How, was the making judgments as opposed to just laying out the facts? So that's one level. The report itself could simply lay out the facts that we already know, or it could be more damning. The potential for a police investigation, which I still sort of suspect isn't going to happen, but if that were to happen, that could land him in a whole other sort of realm of trouble. I still think that the key question isn't really what's said in these reports, but whether his party, his own backbench, decides he's more of a liability than a meal ticket, as I wrote, and also whether they really, really think that one of the potential, Boris Johnson replacements is going to be able to do what he did to carry on this legacy. That 2019 election victory was a generational change for this party. He's remade what the Tories stand for. It's a big, ask for even a Rishi Sunak or Liz Truss, who are popular with the grassroots party, to take that on. And I think that's what the Tory MPs will have to be asking themselves. Are either of them, do they have the potential, the charisma, the instinct, the killer instinct to really take that mantle?
Yeah, surely if you can get through those hurdles, then the May elections are going to be the really big test, because bad opinion polls, they come and go. Yeah. It's midterm. They would normally be expected at this time, this time in the cycle.
Yeah, and they've been in power for a long time. I mean, Boris Johnson represents a kind of break for the Conservative Party, a sort of new and a new Tories, a sort of, reset. But they have been in power well over a decade. I think one of the things keeping them there is that the Labour Party has just been, chronically incapable of mounting anything that looks like a serious challenge. That seems to be slowly improving. Whether they can, really maintain a poll lead that's based on anything but kind of dissatisfaction with Boris Johnson in the government, I think that remains to be seen. But, it's looking like a closer contest.
Yeah, and yet it's not, you wouldn't call it an impressive poll lead, would you? That you got a poll in the Times, 38% Labour's on. That's hardly a commanding lead, is it?
No, and even, the most popular Labour figures, I mean, you could look at Sadiq Khan, or their popularity is so low. I mean, it's in the 20s. So I think we're a long way from the public being excited by a Labour leader, let alone, an entire front bench that would replace the government in office, or is credible on economic policy.
I want to talk to you about something else you've written about, which is the future of the pandemic. Now, the government is keen to talk about us moving to an endemic stage of this whole business. What does that actually mean for the UK? Can we say yet?
Yeah, and for once, I think the government is absolutely right here. We went from a situation where we had a highly transmissible virus that was conferring you know, pretty serious high levels of disease, with many people ending up in hospital and, you know, a tragic number of deaths, to having vaccines, which gave us enormous protection, treatments, which, you know, while still bedeviled by supply problems, offer also another line of defense, to now the Omicron virus, which, you know, we withheld judgment for a while. We wanted to see what, you know, the data showed. It's now pretty clear that, you know, with natural immunity, with vaccinations, and with the way this variant, the different effects it has on the body and on the lungs, we have better defenses against a weaker virus. And that means policy needs to adjust to reflect that. And we can have a great deal more openness than we've had up to now.
Seems like a lot of the problems with the pandemic, particularly in the health service, are not really to do with illness from COVID. They're to do with staff absences. And that has to do with the isolation rules for people who test positive, many of whom are not actually ill. Do you think at some point we're going to have to grasp that nettle and perhaps get rid of isolation altogether, or certainly limit it way beyond what we've already done?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, first of all, we're not enforcing self-isolation. It is very difficult to tell people who, you know, have effectively the symptoms of a cold or no symptoms at all to stay at home for 5, 6, 7, you know, in some places, 10 days. With, you know, we know that the Omicron variant is highly transmissible. We also know that masks work. So I think telling people to stay home if they have symptoms, to test if they're unsure, to wear masks prudently, you know, those will be sufficient defenses against a weaker virus in a population that has very high levels of natural immunity. And in England, we're looking at 95% of the population has antibodies, very high levels of vaccination, and high booster rates. We're over 60% now, and that's climbing daily. So I think we can really revisit the self-isolation policies and, you know, other things eventually. I mean, work from home guidance also seems really overkill at this point. I think people should be allowed to go into the office, encouraged if they want to, you know, subject to agreement with their employers. And, you know, eventually we might have to look at mass testing and say, do we want to subsidize, you know, daily, weekly tests for everyone, or do we want to put it to parts of the population where a greater level of certainty and risk reduction makes more sense? Do we want to just have free mass testing at times when there are new variants or the virus rises? So, you know, this isn't a call for complacency. I think this needs to be monitored. Responses will vary according to the country and region, but really does mean that we need to rethink a lot of these things we've become used to.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.